Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 18, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, our July 2014 update. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts to discuss this topic. The first is Mr. Wayne A. Abernathy, who is Executive VP for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and the second is Professor Todd J. Zwicky, who is the Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. More complete bios for both of our speakers were provided to you all in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations and discussion, and as always, followed by your questions. So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Wayne Abernathy, who's going to get us started. So Wayne, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Christian, and good afternoon to everybody on the call. Wayne Abernathy here in Washington, D.C. I'm here to help you. I'm here to talk about an agency that policymakers created out of the Dodd-Frank Act with the intent of helping everybody who's a consumer of financial services, which I think in the United States is just about everyone. So this bureau, in theory, is for you. We have at the Financial Services Practice Group at the Federalist Society each month had a special report on activities of the Consumer Bureau, since it's been a very active agency since its creation. And our working group, led by Jerry Lozier, each month would put together a list of the latest things that the Bureau had been up to. And it was a pretty lengthy list. And it occurred to us that it might be valuable to share that with other people who aren't particularly calling into our practice group sessions. And that's the purpose of this call, to share with you some of the latest developments of the Bureau. This is intended to be a survey, not an effort to get into great depth on any particular issue, other than to the extent any of you may wish us to do so with any questions you may be offering, which we will entertain toward the end of this call. In a minute, I'm going to turn to my colleague on this call today, Professor Zwicky, but I just wanted to express to you our appreciation for your interest in the Bureau, the challenge that it presents to the ability of private financial firms to meet their customers is very significant. It's based upon the theory that unless there's a government agency in Washington protecting consumers of financial products and services, that you'll all be left naked to the exploitation of unscrupulous providers of those products and services in the private sector. That's the theory that's behind it. The authorities that have been given to the Bureau are extensive, and they've been used in an increasingly, I would say, intrusive fashion. So watching what this Bureau does, given the very limited oversight that Congress provided for the Bureau, is an important function, I think, for all of us. And that's what we're trying to do with this call, is provide you a survey of some of the latest activities so that you're aware of what's going on there. With that, let me pause and turn the time over to Todd Zwicky to introduce himself and then lead off with our first issue.
Hi, thanks, Wayne, and thanks, everybody, for coming in today and joining us. I'm going to start off with something that's not directly a CFPB issue before we move into it, but one of the things that is perhaps the one of the most important issues on the consumer credit landscape today, which is the Operation Choke Point operation being run by the federal government. Some of you may have called into the Telforum conference we did a few weeks ago on that topic. With Chuck Cooper and Ian Murray of CEI. And if you're and there have been some developments in that over the past few weeks that we thought would be useful. For those who are not familiar with Operation Choke Point, it is this very secretive operation with several government entities involved, the DOJ, the FDIC, apparently the Federal Reserve, the OCC, and perhaps the FTC and the CFPB. And the reason it may be of interest to people in this sector is because there is some evidence that they've specifically targeted payday lenders. And what Operation Choke Point purports to do is basically use the banks to choke off the oxygen for what they see as bad actors or potential bad actors, which they identify as everything from home-based charities to those who sell fireworks, firearms, and in payday lending. It's been a very secretive operation so far, but there have been a few developments. The first was a lawsuit was issued a couple weeks ago by the Community Financial Services Association, basically a trade group of the payday lenders, that says that several of their members have lost their bank accounts as a result of Operation Choke Point. Then this week there were hearings, two hearings in Congress this week to get to the bottom of this in two different committees. So it's very active on Capitol Hill trying to flesh this out. And yesterday at a conference that was sponsored by the Mercatus Center and the Cato Institute, Patrick McHenry, chairman of the Congressional Oversight Committee, said that based on recent hearings, he concluded that the primary actor, or a primary actor, and this is the FDIC, and that they're the ones who are kind of taking responsibility for it. And even though the OCC and Federal Reserve are kind of around this, they're not specifically involved in it. The role of the DOJ, which seems to be very important, still seems to be somewhat unarticulated. But obviously this issue of being able to choke off financial services for businesses that are considered politically incorrect, for want of a better word, is something that's being very closely watched in Washington. There's this lawsuit pending, it's something to keep on top of as information dribbles out through congressional hearings and the like.
Well, thank you very much, Todd, and there's certainly more for us to dig in with that. I would point out, some of you might have noticed that in American Banker newspaper today, unaffiliated with the American Bankers Association, is an op-ed piece from Bill Isaac, former FDIC chairman, where he discloses some items from a recent Department of Justice memorandum about Operation Choke Point, where they're very explicit about outlining their strategy to go after institutions that they, for whatever reason, can't or won't bring enforcement charges against, and instead try to get a bank to cut off access to those institutions, to cut off their activities. And it's kind of a smoking gun in terms of the role of the Department of Justice and what they're trying to do. So I think that's available currently online at American Banker, their website. Again, not affiliated with American Bankers Association. Well, I'd like to follow up as sort of the next item. We had just recently a testimony from the director of the Consumer Bureau, Director Cordray, and I wanted to just hit a couple of the highlights that he did. This is the semi-annual requirement to give a report to Congress on the activities of the Bureau for the previous 6 months. This is one of the few elements of what you might call meaningful oversight that exists under the law and accountability for the Bureau. The director actually has to go up and talk about what he's doing, but beyond that, there's pretty limited oversight and accountability. But let me touch on some of the key points. He points out that this was his fifth report. He emphasized, this is Cordray, Director Cordray emphasizes that, quote, through fair rules, consistent oversight, appropriate enforcement of the law, and broad-based consumer engagement, those are the tools, and that's the end of the quote there, those are the tools that they use to try to meet their mission. And he points out that through their efforts, they have, quote, aided in efforts to refund more than $3.8 billion to consumers, end quote. The next point that I'd highlight from the testimony, he says during that reporting period, the previous 6 months, which would be the first 6 months of this year, he indicated that they completed their major mortgage rule under Dodd-Frank, a rule to consolidate and improve financial disclosures, bringing together the Truth in Lending Act and the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act into one disclosure, which they call their Know Before You Owe program. And they have issued an advanced notice of public rulemaking on debt collection. What's curious about that rule, I would point out, is that it proposes to take standards that were developed for third-party debt collections and apply them to original debtor creditor relationships with the originators of those loan situations, which the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act weren't intended to reach to, but nevertheless his belief is, or his proposal, is to take the standards for third-party debt collections and apply them to originators. A couple of other points from his testimony that I'll mention here, and again, we're very happy to dig into any of these in any detail that any of our callers may wish us to when we get to the Q&A portion. He points out that the Bureau, quote, to promote informed financial decision-making, they have created on their website, their Ask CFPB section, which has over 1,000 frequently asked questions. I personally have not dug into any of those 1,000 questions to see how helpful they are, but I'd certainly be interested in hearing from any of our participants on the call today who have and who have any observations on the value of those 1,000 FAQs. Another point is, as of July 1, 2014, they report that they've received over 375,000 consumer complaints on a variety of different financial services that are provided. He points out in his testimony they've benefited from an ongoing dialogue and constructive engagement with the institutions he supervises. And then his last part of his testimony, which I think is a little bit curious, and I think Todd is going to get into that a little bit later in our call here, is that's relationship between the management at the Bureau and its employees. In his testimony, in his semi-annual testimony, the director points out, quote, the Bureau's employees are our greatest asset, and goes on to say, quote, I took decisive and comprehensive action to remedy the problems related to our preference rating system after our analysis showed ratings disparities across a wide range of employee characteristics. We negotiated with our union to discard the system. That's end quote. There had been significant criticisms that there was a disparate impact in the rating system of affecting minorities and women in ways that seem to be not as balanced as others in the Bureau, and their solution was to end entirely any kind of performance rating system. And then his last point is we have also instituted additional mandatory equal employment opportunity training for all of our managers. Well, that's where I'll stop in terms of hitting some of the highlights of that testimony. Again, we can go into those or other issues at any detail you'd like. And in just a moment, we'll go back to Professor Zawicki, who would like to talk to us about one of the more troubling standards that the Dodd-Frank Act gives as a powerful tool to the new Bureau. Todd.
Remind me which standard we were going to talk about.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's the abusive standard, Todd.
The abusive standard. Okay, good. Because we were also going to talk. I was going to talk a little bit more. Let me just elaborate on some of Wayne's points about the hearings that have been going on, and maybe this is a little bit out of order what we're going to talk about. But there was also some recent hearings by some of the employees that Wayne referred to, and in particular, there was kind of a blockbuster testimony by this fellow, Ali Naraghi, who had been an examiner in the Southeastern Regional Office of the CFPB. And there were a number of things he talked about in terms of employee morale issues and that sort of thing that Wayne alluded to. But perhaps the most interesting thing for people on this call was during his testimony, he alleged that there's a pattern of results-oriented examinations at the CFPB, that basically it's staffed by staffers who have little or no experience in the financial services sector, and that the supervisors in particular are largely unqualified many of them are unqualified for their position. And so he recounted a situation in which he was examining a bank with regards to mortgages, and did a survey and found, I think he said, that reviewed 42 mortgages, found no problems, reported this back up the chain, and was told that essentially he had obviously done it wrong and he needed to go back and continue examining until he found some problem. There's, you know, a whole host of complaints by senior employees in particular with respect to a lot of these issues, and Congress has been digging into those issues as well. With respect to the abusive standard, which Wayne raised, those on the call may be familiar that the CFPB has the power to reach unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices. And with respect to unfair and deceptive, they largely have inherited the FTC's rules with respect to that. Abusive is the new power that they have, and people have been sort of wondering how that's going to unfold. And we now have at least two key cases that I think start to give a sense of how the CFPB is going to use abusive and how they may use that power in a way that's different from the unfairness and deceptive ideas that have been around for a while. They did a case a little while back against ITT College, which is a for-profit college, and recently Ace Cash Express. They just entered into a consent agreement with them this week. And what it appears is they've said from the beginning that they're not going to initiate a rulemaking with respect to abusive, that they will define it through enforcement actions. And so these are particularly important. And as I read the cases, and I'd be interested in anybody on the call, any feedback on this, what it appears that we see in both ITT and the Ace Cash Express model that distinguishes abusive from the other standards is that in both cases, the CFPB essentially alleges that the companies are making their money not off of the initial loan, but instead creating a situation in which the borrower is kind of set up to with a loan that they cannot actually perform and that they are likely to default on after some designated period of time, or essentially requires a refinancing, a rollover, or it's implied, you know, very high penalty fees, late fees, that sort of thing. And in Ace Cash Express, there were some there was a manual and things like this that sort of pointed to this, but in both cases, what they seem to be getting at is the same notion that you set the borrower up with a loan. It could be completely perfectly disclosed, so it's not deceptive. It could be a product that is not, you know, that passes the benefit cost test of unfairness, but that in some sense the borrower doesn't understand that the real scheme is to make money from a refinancing, a rollover, or something like that. And in both cases, what they have is an allegation that the lender contributed to a sort of sense of urgency with respect to the borrower, and that kind of forced them into to this sort of refinance. I'd be interested in people's impressions of those cases. That's how I read them. And if that's the case, two things. First, it does look like something different from traditional unfair and deceptive practices. And second, it's not really clear how exactly that links up with the statutory language in Dodd-Frank, which is admittedly very broad. It's not quite clear what exactly it means. But note that in both these cases, these are just consent settlements, not litigated cases. So even if that's what the CFPB has decided it means, it's not necessarily clear whether or not, if it were actually challenged, it would fall under the rubric of abusive under Dodd-Frank, which is a maddeningly vague and perhaps capacious standard with very little legislative history and the like. Wayne?
Okay, Todd. Well, I appreciate that. And I just would remind people on the call that we will have ample time for your questions and comments. So if you have any questions of any of the things we go across, please make a note of them, and we'll be turning to your questions in just a few moments. A couple of things you want to cover here before we do that, though. I would like to just spend a few moments to talk about a proposed rule that the Bureau put out for comment, but actually this is a proposed policy statement. And I don't know whether this is an effort to get around the strictures of the Administrative Procedures Act or exactly why the Bureau decided to issue this as a proposed policy statement. But nevertheless, I'll discuss it because it affects an effort to be further innovative if you will, in the regulatory sphere. This is the Bureau's proposal to deal with the complaint, the consumer complaint structure that they have created, and to expand it to include what they call unstructured consumer complaint narrative data, basically, which is the opportunity for anyone to go onto the website of the Bureau and to just write out in any kind of unstructured way they'd like their concerns, complaints, issues that they'd like to take to task with any particular provider of financial services. And the Bureau would be very careful to protect and remove from the information provided any privacy data that might identify the individual who is providing the material, but it would, on the other hand, still leave the for public view the identity of the firm that was the focus of the complaint. Again, I mentioned this is not a proposed rule. This is a notice of proposed policy statement. The Bureau does offer an opportunity for comment on their proposal, a 30-day comment period, which is very much on the short side of any kind of comment period, but nevertheless, that is what they've proposed. The consumer providing the information would have to opt in with the consent of having that information made public, but the intent is that it would be made public. In their explanation of what they're trying to do here, they mentioned that they originally, when they established their consumer complaint database, that the structured one that they currently have, that they wanted to consider whether or not to provide the opportunity for this unstructured commentary from consumers. And they wanted to make sure that they could do a very important thing if they went down that lane, and that was to make sure that they could protect the privacy interests of the providers of the information. They point out in their proposal that consumer civil rights, I'm now quoting from their proposal, consumer civil rights and open government groups supported disclosure on the grounds that disclosing narratives would provide consumers with more useful information on which to base financial decisions and would allow reviewers, I guess that is everybody who reads their comments, to assess the validity of the complaints. And that's a very important point. The Bureau makes no effort to decide or to determine whether the complaints that are made are valid or not before they publish them. They'll publish them as they are after they've redacted what they consider to be the privacy information, and they'll leave it for the viewers to decide whether or not the information is accurate or not. That's their standard for accuracy. And they do note that trade groups and industry commenters nearly uniformly opposed disclosure of consumer complaint narratives. And then before I conclude on this point, let me quote where they emphasize the purpose of this, and I think this is very important. They say, and I'm reading now directly from their proposal, quote, "This could lead to increased use by advocates, academics, the press, and entrepreneurs, which itself would lead to increased consumer contacts with the Bureau," end quote. So it seems to me that is the key purpose of expanding the complaint process to include these narratives. I will make a comment that the consumerist activists, while they're worried about privacy, they're not particularly worried about accuracy. Yet, nevertheless, they seem to forget that they're now a government agency. And as I was looking at their website again today, I noticed right at the top of their website, they include this phrase, quote, an official website of the United States government, end quote. And I don't think they recognize that by publishing these unverified narratives by various consumers, that they're giving them, in essence, an imprimatur of the federal government, a seal of some kind of backing that these have the support of a federal government agency. They don't say that explicitly, but that certainly would be how it would be presumed. Financial institutions do have the option, if they would like, alongside a complaint, to provide a rebuttal, if you will, although they never know quite who they're rebutting to because that part's redacted. So it kind of goes against the, I think, the common law tradition of our nation of being able to face your accusers, but nevertheless, that is what the Bureau is proposing be put out there for comment. Now, what we'd like to do is just, we're going to now tick off very quickly four other items to lay them on the table in case anybody would like to comment on them. I'll turn to Todd here to talk about a research on payday lending project, and also a comment on whether the recent canning decision with regard to the NLRB appointees, how that might affect Director Cordray and the Bureau. So let me turn to Todd for those.
Thanks, Wayne. First, as many people know, payday lending, the Bureau has been looking at that for a long time. This is an issue they've expressed particular interest in, and there is they've issued some research. Their initial research on this was very heavily and justifiably criticized. But there's a whole host of research that's out there as well that they've largely ignored. As Wayne alluded to, there's an ongoing research project to try to talk about why consumers use payday lending and the like. I'm trying to remember where can one find this most recent research, Wayne? Do you recall? Wayne, you there?
Excuse me, I always had myself on mute there to try to
decrease
the background noise.
That's fine. Can you refresh my memory as to where I found this this most recent research? Who was producing it on payday lending?
Yes, let me get that here in front of me.
Right, but there's a large initiative going on to provide research on payday lending. Go ahead.
I did. This is a Professor Richard Hackett, who is a former employee of the Bureau. In a June 19 American Banker article discusses it. I don't have a website for him, but if you go to the June 19th American Banker article, you can find this former Assistant Director of the Office of Installment and Liquidity Markets announced that as he left the Bureau that he was creating this effort to try to get to more and detailed kind of data on the payday lending issues.
Right. And this is from the beginning, of course, this has been the boast of the Bureau is to do good economically informed research along the lines that Hackett himself is doing. In practice, I think it's based in my academic discussions, in practice, they have been an abysmal failure with respect to that. The research that they've done so far has virtually no respect among academics. It's largely ignored other academic research, and some of them, for instance, the initial payday lending study that was done by the Bureau is really just embarrassing with major methodological flaws that would have been pointed out by any serious academics. And so this is an ongoing struggle at the Bureau. The kind of work that Hackett is doing is an important part of it. There's other things going on, but this I think is an interesting issue to watch from the Bureau in that they started off with a very self-assured view of their abilities. They've got access to huge amounts of data, and so far they've largely failed in their boast of producing serious economically informed and data-driven analysis. And so, by and large, they've ignored this third party. To the best of my observation, they've ignored independent scholarly research and one hopes as they roll out the payday lending rules and the like, whatever they end up doing with that, that they'll take into account the research of Hackett and others.
Thank you, Todd. And if you could just take a moment on to respond to the question, which some people have, is to what extent does the Supreme Court decision in the case of the NLRB reach to the Cordray appointment, which was made at the same time?
Yeah, the it's unclear. I mean, the NLRB, we're kind of in a little bit of uncharted waters, I think, which is that the and I'd be interested in other people's responses to this because I haven't been able to find a definitive answer, which is obviously with respect to the NLRB, it really throws everything up in the air because the NLRB lacked a quorum at the time that they acted, and so their things are essentially vacated. As I understand it, in some way, the CFPB purported to ratify the actions taken when they had an illegal director, and I'm not really sure what that means, and I've not really been able to find anybody who has a sense of what that means. Obviously, the real test will be whether or not anybody who was subject to any actions during that period have actually sued in the same way that that Canning did in their case to claim that the actions taken during that period were invalid. The Bureau itself was pretty careful during that period not to do things or make final actions that in and of themselves might provide people with standing to sue. So it's not quite clear, you know, who might be an aggrieved party who might have standing to sue during that period. To what extent actions taken in connection with other agencies might be valid or not. I think it's an open question. The real question, I think, would be whether or not there's anybody who has standing and the desire to challenge it and try to vacate any of the actions taken during that period in which he was illegally recessed appointed.
Great. Thank you, Todd. And Christian, in just a moment, we'll be ready to move to questions and comments from our callers. I want to put two more little pieces on the table, maybe a minute at most with each of them. First one is to note that, remember, the Bureau is part of the Federal Reserve Board, believe it or not, although the Federal Reserve Board has no ability to provide oversight, except that the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve Board is also the Inspector General for the Bureau. And on June 30th, the Inspector General issued a report on the Bureau, the renovation of the Bureau's current facilities. The Bureau is in the offices, housed in the former offices of the Office of Thrift Supervision, which under Dodd-Frank was merged with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. And they have been renovating that building. The initial price of that renovation was $55 million. That price tag has been revised now three times. And most recently, according to the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve Board, that $55 million has now become $215.8 million. Just put that on the table there with regard to consumer protection issues. And then the last one I'll mention, and this is just something to note, the Bureau on July 1st announced that they are reaching out to library systems all across the country to give them access to Bureau resources and the Bureau to be able to provide financial literacy and other information directly to these particular libraries. With that, I think there are certainly many other things we could get into, maybe issues that folks on the call would like us to get into or to dig in more deeply in the issues we've touched. But I think we're ready, Christian, to go to any calls or comments.
All right. We'll now open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to get in line to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we've got our first caller. We'll go right to.
Please, go ahead.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that we may soon see calls for the establishment of a Consumer Protection Bureau to hear complaints about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Yeah, that's something to that.
But I'd like to offer a little insight into what I observed in the mid-80s during a period when the banks and savings and loans were in trouble. Previously, when I was a young man, lending institutions were locally owned, locally controlled, locally managed. You went to church with a banker. They made a loan. They held onto the loan throughout its, you know, its until it was paid off. And they would usually work with people if they couldn't, if they were late some month or, you know, were having trouble. Beginning about the mid-80s, the financial services sector began to transform in fundamental ways, which could very well lead to calls for something like a CFPB. I remember when my own bank started selling its mortgages in order to raise capital, often for deep discounts. And I know some of the people who were doing the buying. And they weren't buying them to collect payments on the loans. They were buying them to prevent people from paying so that they could seize the collateral, sell it at a profit. So the implied arrangement under which people had taken out loans was effectively undermined by now a very different motivation and a very different institutional structure. So we have moved from that into securitization, into where loans are broken up into little pieces scattered over the among many different instruments, in relation to which is highly obscure and often misrated. And I'm afraid that we have done is build a financial structure that is fundamentally non-viable. So we do not need to just do away with the FSPB, but we probably need to do away with most of the financial sector and start over.
Well, John, I'm happy to have that comment, and I appreciate that. I think the key issue that I would bring out in connection with your comment and the structure that we have, and particularly the regulatory structure, is not that critics of the Bureau, and I think you're certainly one, I'm certainly one, are saying that we shouldn't have good law enforcement against bad practices, particularly deceptive and harmful practices such as that. But the question is, should we have an agency that does that, that doesn't have accountability? And I think that's the main criticism that a lot of people have with regard to the structure of the Bureau, is that it answers to no one. There's no real accountability there. At least with the other, the previous system of the banking regulators, they do have to answer to folks. There is accountability. In creating the Bureau, there's no accountability at all. And there's a question of to whether a Bureau without that accountability is going to be truly pursuing the interests of consumers or will have some other kind of political agenda. And I think we fear it's the latter. I don't know, Todd, if you have anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, I'll just add, this is kind of, thank you for that comment. This is kind of indirectly related, which is there's kind of a schizophrenia at the heart of this whole system right now, which is, that people see the value in sort of localized institutions and personal judgments of lending officers and that sort of thing. Leave aside just the economics of that. There's the way that the modern consumer protection structure operates is it actually sees that in a, as I said, sort of a schizophrenic way, which is everybody understands the value of personalized service. The problem is, from their perspective, that they believe that can also result in disparate impact and discriminatory treatment. So think about their assault on the auto dealers with respect to discriminatory lending, right? The model of the dealer being able to sit across from the consumer in the office and negotiate looks like sort of the classic example where a consumer can speak for himself, he can negotiate, he can do all those sorts of things. But at the same time, they see that as the peril in which the consumer ends up getting taken to the cleaners and resulting in discriminatory impact and that sort of thing. So what you get is this desire for personalized service, but then gets overlaid on top of this bureaucratic apparatus, which gets rid of all personalized service. It gets rid of all tailoring. It gets rid of working with consumers in a local situations and that sort of thing. And just think about, for instance, how the qualified mortgage rule is playing out and will play out, which is you can now get in trouble for making a loan or not making a loan to exactly the same person. which is if somebody isn't doesn't have a high enough FICO score, it's a consumer protection issue if you make a loan to them. If FICO scores, for instance, are correlated with demographics, which they are, and that becomes an important part of the underwriting standard, then in that situation, you can end up with a disparate impact. And we're basically living in this world in which there's this hugely prescriptive, bureaucratized set of rules overlaid upon the traditional banking model. And there is a sense, I think, and consistent with what you're saying, in which it's hard to see how a sensible system of competition and consumer choice can operate in that world where you have so many inconsistent goals pushing against each other.
Great. Thank you for that comment question. Do we have another comment or question on the line?
We have we have no callers currently on the line. If you'd like to ask a question, our lines are open. Press star and then the pound key.
While we're waiting,
I don't know if there's anything. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, as Jerry Lozier's team has given us really a good list, so there's many things to go to. There's no one currently lined up.
Oh, wait, that prompted an influx of questions. We had three just jump right on the
line.
Okay,
well, let's go right to those.
All right.
Sure. Go ahead, caller.
Is your organization or group at all interested in or have any input to the mortgage lending problems that are going across the country? I have a good friend up in Ohio who's facing foreclosure now and did a securitization analysis. And man, that loan is, if it didn't fly to the moon and back, I'd be surprised. But have you guys, any of you professors or lawyers taken an in-depth look at this?
Well, there's certainly a variety of different products that are out there, and certainly as we were leading up to the recession and part of the housing bubble, a variety of practices were engaged in to quote-unquote qualify people for loans that they really couldn't manage and couldn't hold on to, and we're still working our way through some of those. I don't know in the particulars of the loan of your friend or colleague has, whether that did have some of these abusive characteristics to it, or he is just the victim of the economic downturn. But there's certainly a lot of problems in the current body of loans. I will say of loans that are being made, mortgage loans that have been made in the last couple of years, most if not all of those practices have been pushed out by both regulators and the marketplace. Next call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. Can you give a listing of what various litigation matters there are and where they are in the pipeline, whether in the federal courts or the administrative procedures, so we can kind of keep our eye on what's going on?
Well, that's a good idea. Todd, got any comments on that?
That's a good question. So many of the CFPB's actions so far have been done by settlements, and what they seem to be doing is, some people on the call may be familiar with the ongoing debate at the Federal Trade Commission about this and sort of the question of agency settlements as a form of common law, and there's a sense in which it looks like the CFPB may be trying to adopt the model of the FTC, which is basically releasing high-profile settlements and sort of defining the law through these settlements. One of the things that I think is interesting about that is that those matters, of course, are obviously not contested. You've got the CFPB, when they do this, is obviously trying to push the law in a particular direction, but it's never fully litigated. So, for instance, if you go back to the example I gave about the abusive standard, what they seem to be trying to define as the evolving standard of abusive, it's not clear that that's consistent with the statutory language, number one. But number two, the parties with whom they enter into the settlement agreements probably don't care that much as to whether or not their particular practice is defined as deceptive versus abusive. But the concern would be is that so then the CFPB can fill up the term abusive with what they wanted to fill it up with, which is, you know, these relatively broad sorts of definitions that they then can use to try to shape the market without anybody ever litigating it. Unless you're aware of ongoing cases, Larry, I'm not familiar with any cases, any significant process in the pipeline. My understanding is that the Morgan Drexen case, which had been taken to court, the Morgan Drexen lost on their lawsuit for a TRO into their constitutional challenge to the CFPB. But so far what they've been doing is avoiding litigation and basically defining the law through these one-sided settlements, which I assume they will then point to in the future as basically being their definition of abusive, and thereby basically push the market and the behaviors in the direction that they want without ever having to actually litigate it in front of a judge. So hopefully at some point some of these cases will actually end up in court where judges can actually define what these terms mean rather than just the CFPB.
It almost seems to me, Todd or Larry, if you have comments too, that the Bureau is doing its best to avoid anything being settled by a judge because they're afraid of the outcome or the precedents that might be set.
I mean, I think that's exactly the problem. I agree with you, and I wondered maybe I'd missed the cases. It seems to me that their argument is their settlements establish precedent. So if you're going to go to court, you're going to lose because we've established this settlement precedent, which is kind of a strange way to proceed in federal litigation. It's certainly outside my experience, but that's what seems to me to be going on, and I suspect, although I don't follow it the way you guys do, that when they get to the really difficult cases, where the odds are they're going to lose it bad, if not lose it, they're going to find a way around it and to settle it. I don't know if that's your view as well.
Well, I think so. And one thing that I'm seeing here, and I appreciate Todd's comment on it as well, is that rather than trying to create a pattern of legal precedent that they can enforce in the courts, they're trying to create a regulatory feeling of what is best practices that they can then go and enforce against the institutions that they supervise and say, look at these various settlements that we've had. That's clearly establishing what the new best practices are, and all of you ought to be following that.
I think that's right, Wayne. And when you combine it with the other initiatives that we see, such as the auto dealer thing, where they've basically deputized the banks as an arm of the federal government to enforce, you know, to basically remake the auto lending market without any sort of rulemaking, without any sort of actual litigation, that sort of thing. When you see, although it's not clear what their role is in Operation Choke Point, but things like that, where you basically see these other situations in which they use the leverage over one party, often banks, in order to reach customers of the banks or customers of the banks or things like that. All that is done outside of the standard rulemaking, litigation, sort of any rule of law process. I laughed earlier when Wayne was describing their policy statement and was trying to think about whether does the APA actually require 30 days for a policy statement, whatever that is, of comments, right? They're doing all these sort of processes that seem to evade and are designed to evade standard rulemaking processes, being in front of a judge, and those sorts of things. Whether it's not litigating cases, or basically just using parties over whom they have leverage to basically create practices among third parties, such as auto dealers.
Yeah, thank you, Todd. I note that on their notice of, again, just I love this term, it isn't a rulemaking, it's a notice of proposed policy statement. They indicate that they're not required to put this out for comment. They're kind of doing us all a favor by allowing it to be put out for comment. So very interesting. Do we have other questions?
Yep, we've got one more on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to jump in, it is star and then the pound key.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
David Emerson, Society member here in Berkeley, California.
Great.
A couple of questions for the speakers. First has to do with the publication of comments, the complaints that are submitted to CFPB, and your thoughts on whether there's potentially a defamation risk or a defamation angle, because some of these complaints are pretty much over the top. I've seen a few of myself that way. It can be very damaging to a company or corporation's reputation. And whether the CFPB in the position as a publisher has a defamation risk that's been analyzed. And then my other question is more of a broader one. It has to do with just the general nature of the solutions that are being proposed, and whether, and this is something that Federalists tend to favor, whether there are really kind of marketplace solutions which actually could be much better, more responsive to the types of problems. And in particular, when we're looking at things like predatory lending, just whether or not there's a complexity issue where consumers are asked to enter perhaps in the most significant transactions of their life and have a complexity which goes beyond their functional capacity. They're basically functionally illiterate in entering into these transactions. And potentially whether there's a marketplace solution which is sort of the counterpart of underwriting for the lending side, but an underwriting for the borrowing side. Yeah. That would put a buyer in a better position to enter into these transactions, and having a third party, basically give it the stamp of approval. So I'd like your thoughts on those two questions.
Boy, excellent questions. And if I may suggest, Todd, if you would take the first, I'm happy to take the second. I'm happy to address either of them, but I'm thinking you might have more expertise on that first question, whether there's a defamation issue with these public narratives that they're proposing to be publishing on their website that has at the top of their website the phrase, an official website of the United States government.
The truth is, when you were talking about that earlier, Wayne, I was actually thinking the same question that David had. David, do you have an opinion on that, whether you think there might be a defamation issue there? That's kind of outside the realm of financial services specifically, but I was thinking the same sort of thing, which is if they are facilitating defamatory comments, or if the CFPB itself ended up breaching consumer privacy, despite the fact that they're claiming that they would protect consumer privacy, would that potentially open them to some sort of litigation risk or something like that as well?
I can imagine that it would. It's something that I've tried to analyze a little bit. The corporations tend to have somewhat of a less protection under the law than individuals for defamation. But it's a combination of both common law, tort law, and also statutory law across the 50 states. So it's not an easy question to answer.
Yeah, I will say in their proposed rulemaking, that's not a rulemaking, in their proposed policy statement, they wash their hands of that issue. They make it very clear that they leave that to the reading public, or they call the reviewer, to verify the accuracy of the comment. I'm not sure that that's the standard for defamation under elsewhere in the law, that we just leave it to the public to decide whether you've been defamed or not.
I believe that's right, Wayne. There's pending litigation against Yelp, for instance, on precisely that question about a vendor who claims that basically Yelp was furthering a libel action, that destroyed that harmed their business, and they went after Yelp, and they were trying to get access to the underlying user who was posting the comments. So I think that is, there's a clear analogy there.
Any more comments on that question before I go to the second one? On the second one, I think you make an excellent point with regard to there are a variety of financial instruments that are extremely complex because the needs may be complex, the laws involved are complex, and maybe tough for any particular investor or participant in that financial transaction to have the expertise necessary. And I begin with the general rule, never invest in anything you don't understand. But there are the public markets in many of these financial institutions have created an answer to that solution. When I'm interested in investing in various stocks or other types of products, I can go to someone who is an expert and who can be a fiduciary for me and make sure that I understand and is operating in my best interest so that my investments are being done in a way that I want them to be done using the expertise of someone else who has the training and the understanding to do that. Could that happen with other financial products and services? I think that it would. I think the danger is when you create a bureau like this that it stifles the development of a marketplace solution because everybody assumes, well, the government will watch out for me. If I make a mistake, the Bureau will take care of me and clean up the mess.
I mean, let me just add to that that one danger with the Bureau is elevating simplicity is an end in itself.
Yeah.
Obviously what we want to have are products that are the appropriate level of complexity such that it's the economics driving it, not disclosure rules and that sort of thing. And I point to a credit card, which is, just an inherently complicated product because people use credit cards in very complicated manners. You use it for cash, you use it for purchases, you use it for credit, all these sorts of things. And so it's just going to have a lot of terms just because they are complicated products and people use them in complicated ways. And so there's a balance that needs to be struck between making products understandable to a degree for consumers, but not artificially forcing them to be simpler than is optimal for consumers. And that's not an easy task, and it requires some degree of skill that in understanding, a deep understanding of the product, why consumers use it, and the like. So.
That's an excellent point, Todd. As you might recall, in the initial proposal form to create the Bureau, when the administration made the proposal to Congress, they were going to give the Bureau the authority to create these plain vanilla products and require providers of financial services to offer the plain vanilla product before they offered anything that was any more complicated than the plain vanilla. Even Barney Frank recognized that was a dumb idea because it would be dumbing down the quality of financial services that may need to be more complicated to meet the needs of certain investors or consumers of financial services. I think we have time for one more comment or question. We have any lined up for us here, Christian?
It looks like that's it. So maybe we can do just one last call for questions. If you'd like to get one in our time, speak now, star and then the pound key. If anybody out there has one last question.
Well, the line is open. I'll just say, I'll just emphasize what Wayne said at the outset. This is our first one of these. We're interested in gauging whether or not there's ongoing demand by Federal Society members and others for us to do this on a regular basis. And we'd like to definitely hear feedback, presumably through Christian or me or Wayne. You can easily find me. As to what you thought was useful in the call, what you thought wasn't useful, whether you think it's something that you're interested in potentially participating in a regular or semi-regular basis, so that we can have some guys, it's a service we offer if people are interested on a going forward basis. And so just let us know what you're looking for.
That's exactly right, Todd, and I appreciate you making that point. And I will also say, if any of the topics we've touched on today you believe requires a more in-depth discussion on one of these telefora, let us know, and we can certainly meet that need as well.
I'll just add one last sort of self-promotional thing. I did a paper that came out a couple weeks ago on the effects of the Durbin Amendment on bank account fees and that sort of thing. Some people may be interested in that as it relates very strongly to ongoing issues of financial inclusion even these crazy ideas like post office banking and that sort of thing, which in other regulatory issues which are emerging towards the front as we slowly but surely through Dodd-Frank and other regulatory structures are taking away the ability of banks to offer services to low-income consumers and then coming up with these cockamamie strategies like post office banking to fill the void, as opposed to thinking about, as John Rowland to some extent suggested earlier, a comprehensive way in which we can create a modern in consumer-friendly financial regulatory system rather than what we've come up with today.
And with that, back to you, Christian, and thanks to everybody participating in our call.
Excellent. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Wayne Abernacki and Todd Zwicky for being with us. Thanks again to our audience. As they mentioned, we always welcome your feedback. You can do it by email to info@fedsoc.org. If you want to look up our speakers as well as myself, we're happy to take your comments directly. And stay tuned for more Telefora in the future on this topic and on others. And you can always stay apprised of all the Federal Society material at our new website, same address with a makeover, fedsoc.org. And so until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.